Hawaii has a problem with affordable housing. The lack of available places to live within most residents' price range has become a major challenge for communities across the islands. Basic laws of supply and demand tell us that the price of something is high, we need to produce more of it to lower that price. But the issue is not so black and white, according to some local developers.
We are by far and away the hardest place in the country to deliver housing. And for us to make it harder makes no sense whatsoever. You're going to get less of it, not more.
Say, hypothetically, I have a piece of property in Kaka'aku with an antiquated warehouse. Well, our vacancy factor on commercial warehouse industrial today is less than 1%. We've got one of the tightest markets in the country and one of the best yields in the country. If I build rental apartments, I'm subject to this 30-year mandatory affordability. I'm not going to go build it. I can build a new warehouse or a commercial building, not provide any affordable housing. Don't constrain a private landowner of his property rights.
You know, as much as we all want it and we want to force somebody to do it by waving a wand or pounding a hammer, it will not get built. And we'll end up with 30% or 25% or 15% or whatever the number is of zero.
Those are local real estate developers Daniel Cody, Stanford Carr, and Scott Settle, commenting on a plan put forth by Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell over the summer to require that affordable rental apartments be included in future residential development projects. His reasoning was that a significant portion of Honolulu residents are below the area median income, or AMI, and cannot afford Oahu's rental market.
An 80% AMI level for an individual is $56,000. For a family of four, it's $80,000. The starting salary of a teacher today is $46,000. 60% of the people who work at the city and county of Honolulu, they 10,000, are below 80% AMI.
But the New York City development firm Bronx Pro Group, LLC, has successfully been constructing affordable rental units in New York's sky-high real estate market, still turning a profit. They're called micro units, and the firm is bringing them to the booming Honolulu neighborhood of Kaka'ako. Conversation producer Ryan Finnerty spoke with Bronx Pro Group's Samantha Magistro to find out how they do it.
Micro units are a little bit unique, and how we really define them is by their size. And typically, they're anywhere from 300 to 305 square feet or less. But these units do have your typical housing amenities with a full kitchen and a full bath.
What benefit does a micro unit provide in terms of affordable housing and the construction of more affordable housing?
Sure. Why micro units are a great use in affordable housing is that it provides a different typology to get more housing units onto the market on smaller sites. So you can take a small site, instead of building, say, maybe 50 units, you may be able to double that to 100.
And what about capacity? If the units are smaller, it would stand to reason that they can't hold as many people. Is there a trade-off in that area?
Yeah, again, affordable housing has to meet a number of different types of family households. And so what we found in New York is that there are a lot of single family households that are overhoused in units that are too big for them. So micro units really target the individuals, and that's the thought process there.
How many individuals is one micro unit designed to house?
So typically you'll have one to two people, two being a max.
So it's not necessarily suitable for a family, but for a couple or maybe a parent with one or two children?
Yeah, it's not really meant to be housing families. It's for the individual household, a single person or a couple.
Are there other markets, either in the United States or elsewhere, where this type of development has been used effectively?
Sure. I think micro units is a model that is being looked at across the country, especially in dense cities. In New York City, there was a pilot micro unit RFP that was successful and built here, and it's occupied, and I know that it had proper demand, and it was very successful here.
Your firm, Bronx Pro Group, is based in New York City, and most of your projects are located in New York. What made you decide to pursue a project here in Hawaii?
Like many things in business, it comes down to relationships. Basically, we were working with an organization that's based in Honolulu, a CM&D, and they brought the micro unit RFP to our attention. But what I would say beyond that is that we're really interested in that innovation in micro units, and that's what attracted us to ultimately apply and be part of the team for that site.
Both New York and Honolulu have very tight real estate markets, and they're both very high-cost areas. Are there greater similarities, more than just that superficial connection between the two areas?
You know, I would say, like, the structural issues of affordable housing is high cost, both of land and construction. So similar to New York, you guys have limited land resources and high land costs. So that comes together. And then additionally, high cost of labor and high cost of construction, that also leads to the, you know, pressure on limited housing resources. So I'd say that's pretty similar.
Affordable rentals specifically are something that have really defeated a lot of developers here. And some of them have come out and said that they're just not even interested in pursuing those types of developments when more profitable commercial or luxury developments can be built. What techniques have you used in New York that have allowed your company to be so successful as a for-profit business in the affordable rental market?
Sure. I will say that, you know, from our perspective, I'd say the first thing is that we are committed to the mission. So we are looking to build affordable housing. That's important to us. So it's, you know, the profit is just one element in how we look at or gauge success in our business. So that's the first kind of caveat. But what I will say about New York City is that we have a lot of resources, and they've had a lot of land resources. So we get city-owned land at reduced values, which have been able to, you know, kind of build our business with that. So I would say that's also what brought us to the table.
Is getting land either from a city or state or at some kind of heavily subsidized rate, is that sort of a prerequisite to creating one of these developments, or can it be done on a purely private scale?
So I would say that certainly helps, having subsidized land. It facilitates the transaction, and there's certain communities where I would say the barriers to buying land are so high, the costs are so high, if you think of like downtown Manhattan. But in general, we have been able to work with the city in some of the outer boroughs, especially the Bronx where we are, where we can buy sites at market rate, and we're able to work with them to get the resources to pencil the deals. So again, it really comes down to having resources and the desire by the city and the state to put those resources into these deals.
When you look at siting a location for one of these affordable rental projects, are there certain factors within the urban space that you look for in choosing a site?
I think, you know, every developer is different. I think the biggest factor for our firm is that we're looking to build communities. So we're looking for sites to build on past investments and to continue like that deep community building and affordable structure, you know, providing affordable housing and community building in the neighborhoods that we serve. So to me, that is probably the biggest factor in terms of choosing a site and going after a site.
I see that the development your firm is working on here in Honolulu will use a panelized building technology, and that they're also going to be environmentally friendly units. Can you explain a little bit about those two features of the project?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the panelized structure, we're not going to be using a panelized system. That might have been in some of the prior press, but we've been able to come to a more affordable model to build more traditionally. But we are going to be very sustainable. One, micro units are sustainable by its nature. You're adding density on a very small site, so that's naturally efficient. Beyond that, we're going to be building towards a LEED standard, shooting for gold certification. And we're looking at solar panels and also thinking about the interiors and how we can be very sustainable.
And for anyone who's interested in moving into this project once it's completed, do you have an estimated completion date? And then also, how will residents be selected for one of these units?
Sure. We anticipate starting construction in the spring of 2018. Typically, buildings can take anywhere from 18 to 24 months to complete. But if we take out the outside date, then we're looking at June of 2020. And if people are interested in the project, they'll be able to apply to our management company, EAH Housing. We'll be doing some marketing via printed press as well as radio. And folks will send in their applications, and then they'll be randomized onto a log, and folks will be processed by in order of their lottery number.
And so we'll get a little bit more information when the opening approaches as to how to submit one of those applications?
Yeah, typically we will start marketing about 3 to 4 months before we anticipate being ready for occupancy. So I would say about at least 18 months to 2 years from now.
And about how many people do you expect to be able to house in this project?
So it'll be 110 households. So it could be either one or two individuals.
Samantha, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Samantha Magistro is the Managing Director of Development for the New York-based affordable housing developer Bronx Pro Group, LLC. That firm was the winner of a bid put out by the Hawaii Community Development Authority to develop a parcel of land on Cook Street in Honolulu's Kaka'ako neighborhood. You can get details of the project on the conversation page of hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, coping with a rapidly spreading invasive on Kauai. But first, your quiz. Whether it's for business or a family weekend visit, most Hawaii residents make an island hop from time to time. This morning, we're looking back at the history of aviation at the man responsible for piloting Hawaii's first two inter-island flights. Launching on March 15, 1918, the first of these flights was a round trip from Honolulu to Molokai. The other took place on May 9th of the same year, flying from Oahu to Maui, and then continued on to the Big Island. Although the former flight was a smashing success, the latter encountered adverse weather and ultimately crashed into the slopes of Mauna Kea. Luckily, the pilot and his crew survived the impact and were able to hike their way from the wreck to safety over the course of 2 days and nights. Can you tell us the name of these historic flights for today's backyard quiz? And for bonus points, can you tell us his military rank? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
It spreads easily, grows rapidly, and does a world of damage. Salvinia molesta is an invasive aquatic plant that quickly forms a thick mat in fresh water that blocks out sunlight from other organisms. There's a serious infestation on Kauai, and Salvinia is not easy to get rid of. Katie Nalisere of the Kauai Division of Aquatic Resources reminded us how easily it can spread.
Could be on a tabi, it could be on fishing gear, or even a water bird. Could be transporting it.
So to prevent the spread, what kind of things do you do?
With our gear, what we do each time we come out is we wash it as thoroughly as possible, visually inspect it, and then we'll let it dry before bringing it to any other waterway. One of the benefits, it does not tolerate salt water very well at all. So when we were doing our cleanup of Kilauea Stream, we'd actually float mats down into the estuary where it will dry up
and let the salt water kill it.
Yep.
When you say mats, that's the problem, isn't it? It forms these almost like blankets over the surface of the water, yeah?
Yeah, it forms these very dense floating mats. And then during this last cleanup, we actually found it kind of has a symbiotic relationship with California grass, where it will use their roots to hold on, kind of expand out, and then the California grass grows on top of that floating mat, and then that allows it to grow even further out into the stream. So they're kind of helping each other further choke out our waterways.
What kind of things do you tell people in terms of looking out for it? You know, if you're out paddling in a stream, what should you be looking out for?
So it can't really grow that well in fast-flowing water. It needs water that stands still or large pools within streams.
Right.
So asking people if you see anything, it only grows maybe an inch to 2 inches above water, and the actual fern piece doesn't look like what you'd think of as a fern. It's a more rounded leaf, and it is pretty. So if you see anything that's light green that's creating these mats, we ask, and it has actually these little threads on it that almost look like egg beaters, white threads on the leaf. If you see anything that looks like that, we're asking you to report it to our Kauai Invasive Species Committee.
What do you then do? Because you can't just yank it out of the water. It's just going to grow back, right?
Yeah, we tried a bunch of different methods of removal when we had a team come over from Oahu last week. So we actually brought over one of our super suckers, is essentially like a floating underwater vacuum.
Right.
And we were using that to take out the large mats, but actually it couldn't remove where California grass was because the roots would actually get stuck in the impeller and jam our super sucker. So we actually do have to do a combination of super sucking and manual removal to get it out.
So that's really labor intensive, isn't it?
It's quite labor intensive, yeah. You don't expect there to be as much as there is because it gets in all that little grass. So in 3 days, we took out about 5 tons of salvinia, and there was still quite a bit left.
That really is troubling. And can you sort of, galvanize the community to help you out?
Yeah, this actually, one thing that's been great, a positive in the negative, is that we've had tremendous support from the residents that live around the stream and other community groups such as Kilauea Ag Park. They actually took all of the salvinia that we removed, and they're going to use it as compost in their gardens. And then we have great institutional support as well. So we've been partnering with Kauai Invasive Species Committee, Department of Agriculture, the County of Kauai, Hawaiian Islands Land Trust. So I think through this kind of effort where we can all get on board together and partner, we'll be able to at least make a dent or do our best at getting rid of it.
Well, Katie, if it's used as compost, does that pose any danger for streams? You know, as you say, it's really minute particles that get this invasion started, yeah?
Well, we were very strategic about it. Kilauea Ag Park is within the same watershed as where we were removing it, so we were sure not to transport it into another watershed to create reinvasion. And Kilauea Ag Park doesn't have water running through it, so it should be able to keep it fairly isolated from a waterway.
Because that's the idea. It sounds as if it spreads very, very readily and very quickly.
Yep, it does. And so if it's out of the water for a short period of time and dries out, it actually dies fairly quickly. So as long as we can remove it from the waterway, get it up and out, it should die, and it's actually a great fertilizer.
Where are the areas on Kauai where it's most prevalent right now?
Right now it's Kilauea Stream, Kapa'a Stream by Kealia Beach, and then we were also surprised to find it in Pu'ukumu Stream, which is a kind of a smaller stream and pretty fast flowing, so we didn't actually expect to see it there, but we have found it there.
Well, keep looking, Katie, because it sounds as if this is a pretty important thing to get rid of.
It is, and we're actually, if the public does see anything, we're asking them to call Kauai Invasive Species Committee at 821-1490, and that's really going to help us. If the public's out there and sees anything, even if they're not sure, if they could give us a call, we'll go out and follow up.
Katie Nalaseri is the Education and Outreach Staff Person for the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Kauai Division of Aquatic Resources.
Undocumented immigrants in southern Texas face a daily dilemma.
People who live here in Laredo are really living in an island. You can't go anywhere north, south, east, west without passing through some kind of checkpoint.
What that means for a woman who needs to see a doctor 150 miles away, plus more reaction to the Republican tax plan this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4, right after Fresh Air.
The fight against invasives takes place along several fronts. On Maui, a tiny insect called the hala scale is threatening the hala tree, an indigenous plant with deep roots in Hawaiian culture. General Assignment reporter Ku'uwe Hiraishi is preparing a story on the invasive and its spread, and she joins us in our studio.
Hi, Aloha, Ku'uwe. Chris.
Thanks for coming in.
Yes, thanks for having me.
This hits hard in a number of ways, right? This is where lauhala hats, lauhala mats, everything comes from.
Exactly. The hala plant is very important to Native Hawaiian culture. We've got, like you mentioned, all the weaving that's done with hats and mats, but
yeah.
We've also used the fruit to make paintbrushes and for food. You make lei with the fruit as well. And then the flowers were also used to preserve feathers and leis. So seeing this hala scale, it was first discovered in Hana, so very isolated, on Maui back in 1995. And it did spread over the decade following that in Maui, but we've only recently found it in infestation on Molokai and also here on Oahu.
And one of the people that you talked to was Derek Arakaki, a specialist in the plant pest control branch at the Department of Ag.
The hala scale is a hard scale that attacks only hala. First, it stops producing fruit. It sucks the nutrition out of the leaves. Then eventually you get a lot of leaf fall. When the infestation gets so high, the plant will die.
Yeah, so that's right. What Derek said is that it kills the entire plant, and that's something new for invasive species. Because it is the hala has been there are scales on hala that don't kill the entire plant.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first where it's becoming a threat not only to the plant itself but to the practitioners that use lau hala as weavers.
Do they understand much about how it gets spread?
They do. So what they've discovered so far is that it's either in the taking of lauhala that has the scale on it.
Right.
So weavers go and pick, and then they take it home. And if it ever moves to another spot, it's going to infest that actual other lauhala plants as well. And that's what they think happened here on Oahu, because it was not here. It was isolated in Maui.
Mm-hmm.
They think it went and got somehow to Molokai from Maui, but that naturally, but for coming to Oahu, it was someone that actually brought the scale with them.
Because we just heard in that discussion of Salvinia, the same thing, how a tiny part of the organism attaches itself to something that's easily transported. Next thing you know, it's on another island, right?
Exactly. So right now, it's very crucial in terms of public education on how it spreads and what to do about it. And that's happening in the Lohala weaving community. They recently had a conference over on the Big Island where the Hala scale was front and center in terms of educating all the weavers on how it is, how it hurts the plant, and what they can do.
Well, you're at work on a story on this, so we'll look forward to hearing more about it. When
yes, next week you'll hear it.
We've got some more people to talk to. Thanks very much.
Mahalo, Chris.
Kuve Hiraishi is the General Assignment Reporter for Hawaii Public Radio's news department, and you can find her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org under the General News tab.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, a look at the medicinal potential of deadly killer snails.
Venom is actually a cocktail. I like to call it nature's deadliest cocktail.
Plus, can you be a self-employed scientist renting out your skills? Science in a gig economy, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon at 1.
And it's Friday on The Conversation, so we're reaching into our letter bag for some of your calls and emails. This week on our talkback line, we heard this.
This is Carl from Kapoho. I just wanted to say, because the rail is so expensive and there's going to be a lot of places where the rail is elevated, wherever we have elevated rail, we should have homeless shelters built that will also support the rail system. So instead of just building pillars, we'll put apartments, and they have to be small. I've lived in an 8-by-12-foot house with a 10-by-8-foot loft for 27 years. It has a bathroom, it has a sink, stove, refrigerator. So it's possible. I've done it. I want to say our attitude is wrong. This is our family. These are our brothers, our mothers, our sons and daughters, our soldiers. They all are our family. So just shuffling these people around shows a selfish, greedy nature of our society. Aloha. I love you all.
Hello, this is Judy Eagle calling from Maui. You had comments by a pilot for Paradise Helicopters. Naturally, he wanted for his helicopter service to have regulation as little as possible of helicopter flight. And, you know, one can't blame him for that. But in making the point that people are complaining about the noise of helicopters, hardly a big surprise, three times, I think it was, he blamed it on newcomers. It's not just newcomers. And, in fact, those who are subject to that, their mental health suffers, the educational level of the kids suffers, but it is a generalized population-wide problem. And he takes away paradise with Paradise Helicopters if he persists in dismissing this.
Dan D'Amizio also wrote in from Pahoa after Tuesday's interview with the director of the film Aloha from Lavaland. Quote, I am the retired director of a nonprofit urgent care facility in the Pahoa marketplace that for a time lay directly in the path of Madame Pele's lava. This was an event that caused enormous stress in our community. People were fearful and upset as the smoke mauka of the village grew closer and closer by day. Sure, neighbors and friends and family hung together, hugging and offering encouragement, and for the churchgoers, offering prayers. The interviewee, however, did not reflect the drama, the sadness, or the angst that we all experienced at that time. Pahoa was about to be bisected, cutting the main road through the village, the access highway, and, within the realms of possibility for weeks, sending a branch all the way to the sea. Pahoa would have been an island with on-land access limited to a single gravel-topped road through Volcanoes National Park. A 90-mile trip for a quart of milk. The village would have, in all likelihood, died. No post office, no banks, no schools, no clinics, no grocery stores. All the elements that define a village and hold it together. No one was sure what would happen, and that uncertainty lasted for months. We did not die, we hung together, but our hearts were very heavy for a while. That interview missed that almost entirely.
You describe Pahoa as a remote down Hawaii, on the Hawaii Island here. I'm sitting in Pahoa right now, and believe me, it's about 15 minutes down a 55-mile-an-hour highway, 20 minutes to Hilo. It's not remote in any sense, and this is what's been used as an excuse for the almost 50 years I've lived here, that this is a remote area. People live in remote tuna subdivisions. All they do is take taxes from us, and they pave their roads in Hilo because we live in a remote town. This is no more remote than Eva is from Waikiki or anything else remote. I'm sitting right here in the parking lot at the library, and I'm not remote, believe me. Pahoa is not remote. I'm sitting in Long's Drugs right now. Cannot be remote if you're on Long's Drugs, you know. Eh? Oh, it's still not remote, Brock. It was 55-mile-an-hour highway.
After last week's segment on the growing economic influence of timeshares, Rose Darling from Maui wrote this on our Facebook page. No unions. Timeshares do not support the local economy the way that hotels do. Here on Maui, their first stop is Costco, and they eat in the rest of their stay. No interaction with local people. Hermetically sealed. Drive the west side of Maui and you cannot see the ocean because the timeshares all tower along the beach. Only climate change, global warming will stop this irresponsible beachfront development. F. Kelly Finn wrote this on our Facebook page following our interview with the Aloha Food Bank. I have to say I was actually appalled at the food bank representative recommending people donate the most unhealthy and actually health-damaging food products as desirable donations, including Spam, Vienna sausages, white rice. I would actually contend these products are at least partially responsible for obesity, heart disease, diabetes, colon cancer, and other health diseases, and to provide these items to food bank recipients is horrific. Thanks for the feedback. You can email us at talkback at Hawaii Public Radio, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line at 792-8217. Pilot Andre Borschberg, alone in his aircraft, flew for 5 days and nights over the Pacific, the longest leg in his team's around-the-world journey. He and his flying partner, Andre Picard, took turns piloting their one-of-a-kind aircraft, the Solar Impulse, on a 26,000-mile circumnavigation of the globe, powered entirely by the sun. The success of their mission carries hope and some object lessons for a clean energy future. The story of the Solar Impulse is told in a documentary being given its premiere this weekend at the Hawaii International Film Festival. The film is called Point of No Return, and Andre is with us in our studio. Hi, Andre. Thanks for coming in.
It's a great pleasure to be back, I tell you.
This project, flying a solar-powered plane around the world, required a great deal of commitment and a great deal of innovation, yeah?
Commitment, perseverance, believing that it was possible, because when we started, and this is 13 years ago with my partner Bertrand Picard, we were told to build an airplane of the size of a 747 that would not weigh more than the weight of a car was impossible, told by the aviation industry. So we had to find our own solutions. We had to find our own way, build up our team to make it possible. But we believe there was a solution. That's the reasons why we started.
Why didn't that discourage you? I mean, these were the experts you talked to, right?
I think I like to contradict sometimes people, and it's extremely stimulating when someone tells you it's not going to work. You know, if you do something easy, I don't think you get a lot of energy. But on the other side, you have to be ready to face obstacles. You may have failures. You have to understand that you learn from these failures. That's a way to move forward and not to be discouraged by it. And I think this was the most important learning I had during the first part until we got the airplane flying.
The plane had to be light enough to be powered by solar. And yet it had to be strong enough to withstand a trip around the world. And the question is, are the materials available that have that combination of lightness and strength?
It had to be efficient. energy efficient. Yeah, that's a bit the same way as, you know, when we look at our world, we always think about producing more and more energy instead of trying to think, how can I better use the energy I have available? Mm-hmm. Maybe better insulate my home, have cars who use less gasoline, better aerodynamic, whatever the solution. And to make this airplane fly with the sun only, and you have to realize that's the first airplane which can fly forever. I flew 5 days because, you know, not longer, not because the airplane couldn't make it, but because I was tired, and maybe because the weather was deteriorating over the United States. So to make it feasible, this airplane had to be very energy efficient, meaning very light, very good aerodynamic, electric motors, because electric motors are much more efficient than combustion engine. And all these solutions that we have in this airplane, you can use them as well. It's not something which was developed for space, extremely costly. No, these are solutions, technologies that you can use in your home, that people will use in the cars to make our world more energy efficient and therefore producing less CO2.
Whenever I hear about projects that are extremely energy efficient, you can't help but reflect on how wasteful our ways of producing energy have been to date, that we locked into fossil fuel a long time ago, and even as technology advances, haven't moved out of it. Part of that's a state of mind, isn't it, Andre?
Very much so, and I think that's really what is well shown in the movie. Is this, which kind of spirit do you need to build up and to get to your destination? Which kind of attitude you have to develop? And very often, you know, in our world, people will tell you it's not going to work, it's impossible, because we don't want to change the way we do things. I hope that this project, and I think the movie shows it extremely well, is an inspiration for people that the impossible is possible.
It's even beyond the whole question of clean energy, because I think a lot of us talk ourselves out of trying to do things, right? Oh, that's just not going to work. I'm not up to that.
You know, think about where we are here in Hawaii. We have a lot of sun. We have trade winds. We have geothermal energy underground, but we still use a lot of fuel and gas to produce the energy we need.
More than any other state.
More than any other state.
Far more.
And the technologies are available. So we have to bring basically the system to shift slowly to this new solution, which will make the price of energy cheaper also for the user here on the island. So it's a win-win strategy.
Well, something's keeping that from developing more quickly than it has, and maybe it takes, you know, your project makes me think it sometimes takes an outsider to shake things up.
Very often so. Yes, if you look at the car industry, the automobile industry in Detroit always told us that building electric cars was not attractive. We had to wait. Then a software specialist, Elon Musk, demonstrated that it's possible, it's feasible, and now everybody is trying to follow on his path. So again, in fact, it's an outsider. It's difficult to change the way we do things. You know, when you are successful in a direction, think about Kodak. Kodak invented the numerical photography technology.
Yeah.
They went bankrupt because they kept selling films.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to get out of the path we know well. And if we can trigger, and I hope the movie also will help to do this, if we can trigger thoughts, if we can change maybe a little bit the attitude towards the potential of change, I think that would be an extraordinary reward for everyone who has worked in this project.
I really think that attitude is the key, Andre. It certainly was the key in what you and Bertrand got off the ground, literally got off the ground.
Yeah, that's true. And but, you know, when we arrived here, also we were so welcomed by a lot of people, the airport, of course, the authorities, the University of Hawaii, who gave us, gave us the possibility to use the hangar to protect the airplane. on the airports. So I'm sure, you know, with these people, we'll be able to change.
Well, maybe Hawaii is a good place to innovate after all, Andre. Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure, and I think it's important to tell everyone that on Sunday we'll show the premiere of this movie. Well, I'll be there so we could continue the discussions we have now with everyone present during this premiere.
Thanks, Andre. Andre Birchberg is the pilot and co-founder with Bertrand Piccard of the Solar Impulse Project. Its story is told in the documentary Point of No Return, which screens Sunday, November 5th at 5:15, and Thursday, November 9th at 2:45 at Dole Cannery, part of the Hawaii International Film Festival. Earlier this morning, we brought you back to the year Hawaii witnessed its first International Airways flights. On March 15, 1918, a flight successfully ventured from Honolulu to Molokai and back. And although this attempt was executed perfectly, the second try encountered serious difficulties. It happened a few months later, on May 9th. The takeoff from Oahu went well, and so did the landing of the primary destination on Maui. But later, the plane crashed into the slopes of Mauna Kea while attempting to land on the Big Island. Despite the hard landing, both pilot and crew survived, and after a two-day hike from the wreck, they found themselves back within the safety of civilization. Today, we ask you to tell us the name of the pilot who flew both planes and his military rank. The answer, Major Harold Melville Clark. We hope you didn't crash and burn on this quiz. Brooke Johnson of Eva Beach did not. He was the first to call in and get that answer right. And if you've got a quiz for us, how about sending in one of your own? You can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The Brazilian composer Antonio Carlos Jobim was the best known and most prolific of a generation of songwriters who revolutionized popular music in the 60s with infectious melodies, a subtle but powerful rhythmic identity, and a seductive mood that quickly spread to cocktail lounges around the world, where Girl from Ipanema quickly became a modern standard. It's a style and a mood that Sandy Tsukiyama knows well. She learned it at The Source, and she'll be performing Jobim's songs tomorrow evening in our studio, accompanied by Dave Yamasaki on guitar. Sandy and Dave are with us in our studio. Good morning.
Morning, Chris.
Morning.
It's good to see both of you.
Good to see
thanks.
You.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Dave, thanks for that accompaniment, because this is what I was talking about, the mood of the, you know, and when I think of Bossa Nova, I think of how strong the rhythmic pulse is while being... It has a gentle feel, but you have a very definite idea of where the rhythm is, don't you?
Oh yeah.
What does that?
It's the African rhythms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do they get played out in the music? How do you hear them?
Well, bossa nova, the style, is
right.
Actually short for samba bossa nova.
Oh yeah.
Which means samba of a new style.
I've always wondered what the distinction was. Bossa Nova just means the new thing.
New style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was changed in samba when the new thing came along?
Well, the genre evolved when Jobim and a lot of his other contemporaries.
Yeah. Luis Bonfa.
Yeah. A whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
Roberto Menescal, Carlos Lira, all of them, this is peculiar to the southern zone of Rio de Janeiro, and then they all played in nightclubs and stuff at night, and then they would get together in somebody's apartment afterwards to share their new songs. And it was apartments So they had to play softly. They had to sing softly.
Okay.
And the drumming is, if anything, a snare with brushes.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of it was, and because samba is a very outdoor, you know, if you think of the samba schools parade, it's with hundreds of drummers all playing in layered polyrhythms. And, you know, very loud, open-throated, chest voice singing.
Yeah.
But with this new style, it had to be very quiet.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're singing about, you know, lovely things or sad things.
Right. There's a melancholy strain to a lot of these songs, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Dave, just to, you're one of the few people I know who can actually play bossa nova rhythm credibly. Could you just play a sort of a chordal vamp to show how that rhythm groove works? There it is.
See, so the thumb is playing a bass line there.
Yeah,
so you can't
play
it with a pick. You have to use all of your fingers on the right
hand.
No,
I know. I remember the first time I pulled out a pick to play a bossa nova song, how horrified the other musicians were. I quickly threw it on the floor. You and Dave brought a song in, and this is a Jobim song?
Yes, it is.
What do the lyrics say, Sandy?
Sadness has no end, but happiness does. It's A Felicidade, which the name of the song is Happiness, and it's one of the originals on the soundtrack of the film Black Orpheus, which was a big winner at Cannes Film Festival. I believe it was 1960, around there.
Yeah, I saw that movie when it came out, and it really changed everything.
Great. That was
song.
One of the catalysts that cemented my decision that I had to go to Brazil.
I imagine.
Here. Yeah. Same here. Made me want to play guitar watching that movie. Really inspired me.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
because you're not banging the guitar, but you're getting a lot of power out of it in a very different way, yeah?
Exactly. And the myth of Orpheus being able to play and calm the wild animals, you know.
Yeah, the sunrise.
That was just really... Amazing.
For people who haven't seen, it's a great movie. Black Orpheus is the Orpheus legend translated to Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah, and set in the carnival time, carnival season.
Yeah.
Well, here's A Felicidade. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure, man.
Dave Yamasaki.
Sing first
Sukiyama.
Thing in the morning. It's not one of my.
With a message that happiness comes and goes, but sadness lasts forever. That's a
that's
nice upbeat message for
as
we go into the weekend.
I was talking about the joy of carnival.
Uh-huh.
You know, that it's transitory, momentary. That people work all year long, save up so that they can buy their costume.
Yeah,
and poor people have those moments of glory on the avenue parading, and then after that, just go right back to the same old, same old.
Wow.
But at least you have, you know, some
better
fun.
Better to have those moments than not have any, right?
Right, right.
Dave, thanks very much for accompanying Sandy on that. It really sounded nice. Sandy, thanks very much
for
coming to the studio.
Chris, thank you for having
me. He's really one of the wonderful modern composers. I love Jobim.
Yep, got to pay tribute to the man.
That's right, we do. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Sandy Sukiyama will sing the songs of Antonio Carlos Jobim, accompanied by Dave Yamasaki on guitar, tomorrow evening at 7:30 in our Atherton studio. It's a sold-out concert, right?
Yep.
But it will be recorded for a future rebroadcast on HPR's Applause in a Small Room.
Yeah, we've got a full band.
All right.
Ah, a beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha e também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo inteirinho se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Ah, por que estou tão sozinho? Ah.
And that's it for this week on a Friday edition of The Conversation. Coming up next week, the price of crude oil has declined a lot in recent years. Why haven't Hawaii's electricity rates followed that trend? And if you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is where you can listen back to today's show. If you want to hear today's show again, get a past show, or find links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our production team is Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinelli, and the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation.